This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Bossy and noisy, but gorgeously sleek. And no, I am not talking about your ex. I am talking about the fiercest, stubbornest bird in the barnyard, the goose. These birds have to graze free. The other thing is sustainability is in their DNA. They only lay eggs in spring so that by fall the young can fly south and harvesting is possible. Now, this noble bird can never be an offhand supper. It should be celebrated. Well, today, forager Hank Shaw comes by to tell us exactly how to do that. So stay with us for the wonders of Christmas goose, picks for the perfect bubbles, and decadent chocolate desserts. We're going to make sure your table is ready for the merriment this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This holiday season, we're partnering with Feeding America to bring help to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table now, your gift will help provide meals to people in need through our partners at Feeding America and their network of local member food banks. Learn how to help at splendidtable.org/give. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. JetBlue's wine captain and co-founder of Best Sellers chain of wine stores, Joshua Wesson, has a very democratic take on wine. He's a self-professed reform sommelier. No longer does he push spendy bottles. Now, Josh is with us today to take some of the mystery out of one of the world's most magical drinks, bubbly. Josh, great to have you back.
It's great to be back.
So, your picks of bubblies for the holidays.
Well, you know I'm a bubblehead.
Yes, I know. I know.
I drink sparkling wine almost every day. And I love sparkling wines that don't require a lot of thought to enjoy, but are intensely and insanely enjoyable and don't require a lot of money because I think that sometimes people get caught up in spending so much on sparkling wine that they never open it because they never think the occasion is big enough or important enough.
Yeah.
And then you lose all the fun of just drinking tons of bubbles. I've been drinking a lot of wine from lots of different places. And this holiday season, I always go to Spain for Cava and France for Cremant and Italy for Prosecco. And there's so much great sparkling wine in the world now that doesn't cost a lot of money. This may be the golden era for bubbleheads.
Okay, now you got to get specific. Let's start with France.
Okay, good place to start because everybody knows about French champagne. But there's a lot of sparkling wine made in France that doesn't come from champagne but is insanely delicious. Probably my favorite for big parties is a wine from the Loire called Charles de Fer. It's a Brut sparkling wine, goes for about $10, $11, and it's not terribly complex, but it is incredibly delicious and fun to drink. And because it's $11, you know, you just drink all you want and look around for more. It's great sparkling wine. If you want to kick it up a notch, Cremant, which is a sparkling wine made in the style of champagne but not from champagne, can be almost champagne-like in quality. And my favorite is made by Lucien Albrecht. And it's a Cremant d'Alsace. It's from Alsace. And he makes two, one in a Brut form and one in a Rosé, which is really a stunt double for pink champagne. And I just think it's great.
Ooh, that sounds great.
About $19.
What about Italy?
Well, I mean, there's a ton of sparkling wine made in many different places in Italy. But the most famous sparkling wine in Italy is Prosecco. And Prosecco is different from a lot of other sparkling wines in the world in that it's a little bit fruitier and sometimes a little bit sweeter than most others. But that doesn't stop it from being incredibly delicious and fun to drink. It's also usually a little bit lower in alcohol than a lot of other sparkling wines. And I picked out two, one on the low side, one on the high side of the price range that mm-hmm. you find Prosecco, which is $10 to $20. Mianetto, very well-known producer, makes a wonderful, consistent, and beautifully packaged Brut for about $12.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
If you want to take it up to a higher level of Prosecco yummy, then Nino Franco makes a Rustico Prosecco And both are made from the same grape, Glera. But, Franco has finer bubbles. It's right. aged for a little bit longer, a little bit more of a handmade product. And that costs about $18, but it's a great, great bottle of wine and worth the step up in price.
Now, I'm thinking of now we go to Northern Europe or the northern areas of winemaking where you have so many whites. Germany, Austria. What about bubbles from there?
You know, years ago it was very hard to find sparkling German wine of any quality in the United States, and you never really saw any Austrian sparkling wines. They were kept to Austrians to enjoy, but now you can find fantastic German sparkling wine. It's called Sekt, S-E-K-T, and one of my favorites is made from Riesling, and it's got a kiss of sweetness. It's made by the Lusen brothers, and it's called Dr. Lusen Sparkling Riesling, and it sells for all of $12. And it's a party in a bottle. It's so delicious to drink. It goes with everything, and yet it needs nothing to make it taste delicious. But if you want a dry sparkling wine from that part of the world, just dip down into Austria and get any sparkling Grüner Veltliner that you could find. They're never more than $20. They're usually between $15 and $20. Mm-hmm. And my favorite of the moment is made by Weingut Ewald Gruber, And it sells for about $17, and it's 100% Grüner Veltliner, which is such a giggle to have as a sparkling wine since most people only know it as a still wine.
Okay, let's go across the world. Australia, because they're doing so much over there.
I just got back from Australia. I was there for pretty much the month of September, and I was completely stunned by the deliciousness of the sparkling wines that I tried there. And two really struck me as being delicious and affordable. One by Jacob's Creek. It's a blend of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. I don't know how they do it, but it sells for about $10, $11 here in the States, and it's bananas. They can put that much deliciousness in a bottle at that price. And the bottle looks very sexy, too, so if you gave it as a gift, nobody would suspect that you're cheaping out on the present.
Well, now they'll know.
Greg Norman has a line of wines, and they've just introduced fairly recently a Brut non-vintage for $17. Fantastic bottle of wine. Beautiful presentation. Really, really delicious.
Picks from the United States?
I'm going to give you three. One from California, which is so obvious and yet not. It's incredibly inexpensive. It's made by a big producer, Korbel, but their Blanc de Noir, in a blind tasting that I just went to, came out as one of the top Blanc de Noir's besting wines that cost two, sometimes three times as much. It's $10, $11. You can find it everywhere, and it's just great. But on the higher end, still under 20, but barely at 19, Scharfenberger, their Brut Excellence, is just remarkable. It is method champenoise. It's aged for a few years. It's a very, very sexy bottle of wine for under $20. And you go up to Washington State, Domaine St. Michel, another solid producer, makes a Brut from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir for $12. Incredibly reliable. Great for weddings. Great for big parties. You can't miss. But my go-to wine when I want to serve a really interesting sparkling wine from the United States that's not from California, not from Washington State, I go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and grab a bottle of Gruet, Brut, or Blanc de Noir. And for $18, you can just fool anybody into thinking that they're drinking something much more expensive.
That is one of the great surprise wines. Josh, thank you. And have a great holiday.
You too.
Joshua Wesson is co-founder of Best Sellers Shops and his newest venture, Best Bottles. Now, his picks are on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, once you have those bubbles in hand, pair them with this recipe for our Lacy Parmesan Frico. Crisp pieces of Lacy salty cheese. Irresistible. A faster pairing is simple. Open a bag of classic potato chips. I'm not kidding. They're delicious with champagne. Oh, and by the way, that recipe for the Frico, it's at splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern are always on the lookout for the survivors, the hometown places that still thrive in spite of the chains. They keep track of them on their website, roadfood.com, and they come by here to tell all. Jane, Michael, hey, good to have you two back.
Hey, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn.
I was thinking you two travel all over the country and you see all of this food. When it comes to giving gifts, what are you thinking about this year?
Food.
Well, I know that, but I mean specifically.
Well, you know, what does anyone buy for anybody? It's usually a sweater or, you know, something that doesn't fit or itches. I have yet to give anybody a food gift that they haven't just adored and wanted more of it. And I think our favorite thing to give is pies.
One of the great things that you can do is to get unique regional pies from all over the country. I mean, pies that you wouldn't have the wherewithal to make at home. Like, for example, a key lime pie. The Key West Key Lime Company will send you up a magnificent, a true, authentic key lime pie. And of course, you have to get it like, I think, 2-day service. But, I mean, this is the classic real Florida key lime pie. And if you don't like pie, they will also send you key lime pops, which is a slice of key lime pie enrobed in chocolate and sent to you in dry ice. So it's on a stick. So you can eat key lime pie, chocolate coated, on a stick. Talk about heaven.
Lynn, do you like mince pie?
I love mince pie. Really good mince pie. And you just don't find it.
I know, because isn't that all the difference in the world between good and bad? The best mince pie we ever had is from the Red Truck Bakery in Warrenton, Virginia. It's in the most gorgeous part of Virginia. And the guy who owns it, he said, I am on a one-man crusade to resurrect the traditional mince pie. And it is the sumptuous suet-rich pastry with lots of bourbon and sugar, and it's just wonderful.
That's what a mince pie is supposed to be.
This is as luxurious as a pie can be, and I don't know how much bourbon is in it, but it does taste intoxicating.
Michael, what about the peanut butter pie that we got in California?
Yeah, it's not a huge pie, but it is so intense that like one normal size pie you can cut into maybe 10 or 12 little slices, and each one is a filling dessert.
And what's so great about it is it's made of peanut butter with peanut butter in it. The pie part is peanut butter and cream cheese, and then there are broken up hunks of Reese's peanut butter cups in it. So it's, you know, it's kind of a double peanut whammy.
Very intense. And we cannot talk about mail order pies without mentioning the apple pie baked in a paper bag from the Elegant Farmer in Maquonago, Wisconsin.
Baked in a paper bag?
Yes. And they claim that somehow the baking in a paper bag, it makes the crust crisper.
Yeah, which is counterintuitive.
Yeah. But it works. It's like a sugar cookie on top. And believe me, we've ordered this several times. We've had it sent to people. Everyone who tastes this pie agrees unanimously this is the best apple pie they have ever eaten, period.
Can I throw one?
Oh,
one
sure.
More in?
Go, please.
The salty honey walnut pie from the Three Babes Bake Shop in San Francisco. The walnuts are from the Old Dog Ranch, which is right near the bake shop. And it's an incredibly delicious pie with honey, scraped vanilla beans, fleur de sel. Very elegant and very on trend, as they say. But, oh, my gosh, it is the best thing. And because it's a walnut pie, it travels very well and it keeps very well.
You know what I'm thinking? What about a pie of the month for someone you truly, truly adore?
Yes.
Well, not to brag, but Michael and I are lifetime members of the Pie of the Month.
Pie of the Month for life.
Right.
And that would be Royer's Round Top Cafe in Round Top, Texas. Every month for the rest of our lives, we get a pie from Royer's, and these are sensational Texas pies, especially the pecan.
And I think the trick here is the pies are so incredibly sweet and rich that your lifespan is very short, so they can be quite generous about Pie for Life.
So they're always in the black, and you're kind of
exactly.
In the red. Yeah, I get it. Okay. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. You can find their picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to browse through all the recipe opportunities, download our podcast, and take a peek at our latest ebook, Eating In with Lynn, Italian Holidays. I am going to get you to eat like an Italian. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Coming up, what does the man behind modernist cuisine, as in liquid nitrogen as a kitchen staple, do for his holiday? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Imagine green pearls rolling around on your plate. Now you bite. The outside is crisp and cool, but inside, warm, lush basil sauce. Well, this is modernist cuisine, the approach to cooking that has chefs rethinking everything that they know. The term Renaissance man is thrown around a lot, but Nathan Myhrvold is the real thing, and he's the man behind modernist cuisine. Now, when Nathan was a little kid, he was given a plastic camera. He's now an award-winning photographer. That same little kid loved dinosaurs. Now he presents papers on them at universities. He was Microsoft's first chief technology officer. Today, he's creating a nuclear reactor with Bill Gates. Plus, he has degrees in physics, mathematics, and space science. So you can imagine that when a man like Nathan turns his hand to cooking, nothing is going to be ordinary. Well, after much research, in 2008, Nathan delivered his six-volume Modernist Cuisine with amazing photos. And it was an instant bestseller and mind-blower with food pros. Next was Modernist Cuisine for the Home, and now he has published, at 13 pounds and nearly the size of a coffee table, The Photography of Modernist Cuisine. Nathan, good to have you join us.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to talk about your path. You've done all of these things, plus working with the physicist Stephen Hawking. How did food come into this?
So I grew up almost next door to a library. And when I was 9 years old, I discovered the cookbook section. And I started reading cookbooks, and I came and announced to my mother I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner all by myself. I had to go to the store by myself and cook it all. And so I got all these cookbooks and I read all of them. I got Escoffier. It turned out that wasn't very helpful for Thanksgiving dinner. and I cooked the dinner. And sort of from that time forward, I was very interested in food. Around that time, I also got my first camera. And I was fascinated with photography. Ansel Adams came to speak at UCLA. I grew up in Los Angeles. And my mother got me a ticket, so I went and I got to hear Ansel Adams talk. And so I was fascinated with photography. And my book projects have managed to combine these two long-term passions, food and photography. Then when I was working at Microsoft, I asked Bill Gates for a leave of absence so I could go to chef school in France. And he let me do it. Of course, the chef school wouldn't take me unless I had work experience. So I actually worked one day a week for a couple years at a French restaurant in Seattle. I'd go in around noon and prep for dinner and cook through dinner and then go home.
So you had all this background, but you now are working in something you've coined modernist cuisine. A lot of people call it, you know, by other names, but this essentially new approach to food science and looking at methods of cooking that we kind of turn inside out and upside down. How did the science piece get in there?
Well, another long-term passion was science. When I was 2 years old, according to my mother, I told her I was going to be a scientist. And while growing up, I was really good at school. I was really good at science things. And that's why I wound up being a physicist and working with Stephen Hawking. So the food path of my life and the science path were really pretty different. But then in the 1980s, a guy named Harold McGee published a book called On Food and Cooking, which really started showing how science was relevant to cooking. And after I retired from Microsoft in 1999, I got more and more into cooking, and I realized that there were a bunch of people like Ferran Adrià of Spain, Heston Blumenthal in the UK, and others who were trying to apply ideas from science to create new kinds of dishes. So I thought, hey, this is great. I need to learn this. Surely there is some big book that explains it all, and I'll get that book, and this will be great. Only I couldn't find that big book. In fact, there was no easy way to learn about modern culinary techniques. By modern, I mean techniques invented in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the really interesting stuff that had been invented by chefs in the 80s and 90s and then into the 21st century, that was really hard to pick up. So I started picking it up and learning from the chefs who were doing it. And I eventually decided, you know, because I couldn't buy that big book of that explained it, maybe I should write it. And I embarked on a process that ultimately led to my first cookbook. So this latest book takes some pictures that were from previous books, but also an awful lot of new pictures that didn't occur in those books, and then puts them on really big paper with really nice high-quality printing to show the photographs and only the photographs without the distraction of the text and the distraction of the pedagogical aspects that those other books really had.
Do you have any advice for amateur food photographers?
Well, you know, photography is about recording light. And so you've got to have a lighting situation that produces really pleasant light. And usually that doesn't occur from having a single harsh light on things. So the single best way to take pictures of your food is to, first of all, get it in a light that's appealing. Usually that is going to mean turning off the flash for your camera or your phone, because the flash will overwhelm the existing light, usually, and that will create a very harsh thing like a deer caught in the headlights sort of look on the food. Whereas if you have light often coming from one side that's a little bit more natural and diffuse, it works wonders. It turns out that our eyes, human eyes, are very good at doing the ratio of very dark to very bright things. We can see very, very large differences in light to dark. A camera, not so much. And as a result, you either wind up having the highlights all blown out in white, or the highlights are okay and the shadows are inky black and you can't see any detail in them.
Mm-hmm.
So you always need more even lighting for a camera than you do for your naked eye. And that's why gentle reflection, reflection off of if you don't have a window, shine a bright light against a white wall. That works very well.
And that'll bounce to the object.
Exactly. And what you're creating is a diffuse, gentle light source. And for most food, that's really what you want.
Nathan, what goes on in your kitchen around the holidays?
Well, food is part of holiday celebrations. It really isn't a holiday if you're not celebrating with food of some sort. And then you have to make the decision, do you do things that are traditionally oriented? So do you have turkey, for example, or do you go in a non-traditional way? And I like to mix it up. I love turkey thighs cooked in the style of duck confit. So you cook them at low temperature for a period of time with a little bit of fat or oil, and it creates this amazing texture. It's always worth exploring things beyond what the original ideas are, so almost any great entree can be adapted to the holidays. To me, I think it's more the spirit of how you share the food and the process that goes around it, the feeling of abundance and sharing, than it is the specific dishes.
Nathan, it's exactly the spirit of this time of year. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Nathan Myhrvold is the author of The Photography of Modernist Cuisine, and he left us with a very reasonable and delicious recipe for sweet potato soup. And you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Why is it that goose is such a rare occurrence on American dinner tables? Well, Hank Shaw wants to change that. He's a cook, a hunter, angler, and forager, and author of Duck Duck Goose. Hank, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is it that you love about goose at this time of year?
That's an easy one. Geese, for me, are – it's a little bit like if you hybridized a turkey and a standing rib roast. It's sort of the best of both worlds. You get crispy skin and you get that delicious medium-rare red breast meat. And then on top of that, you're going to get from the legs and the wings that falling apart, almost confit-like effect where you have the meat just pulling away. For me, that's worth the price of admission.
Okay, but when we buy a goose in the store, what exactly are we getting?
Typically, the goose that you're going to get in the store is from a place in South Dakota called Schilt's. And they pretty much dominate the goose market in the United States, and they actually have a pretty nice product.
So what do they do at this farm? I mean, are there specific breeds that they work with?
The Schilt's goose is kind of a proprietary breed. It's based off the Emden, which is the big giant white goose, but it has a couple of other breeds mixed in with it to basically just suit whatever environment that the Schilt's farm has. And it's a big goose. They're usually between 12 and 16 pounds. You can get them a little lighter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all grass-fed pretty much because geese have to be raised free-range. If you can find them, they die. And geese in general have to be raised on grass because that's what they eat. No one's been able to figure out how to breed a goose that will eat, say, chicken feed, for example.
Right,
it wrecks them and they just die. So it's kind of an interesting throwback to old style agriculture. Geese also are relatively unique in that they pretty much only lay eggs for one period of a year, and that's the spring. So there's a seasonal crop, so to speak, of geese. And they don't really start coming to market until late September, and they're ready right in time for the holidays.
What's your opinion of flavor?
I like it. It's probably the best mass market meat I've ever eaten.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, this goose, because you have to raise it in the old way, is still very similar to the way that you would raise a goose in a small farm at your local farmer's market.
So maybe you could walk us through. We've gotten the goose. We've defrosted the goose. Most of us don't do this every week. What do we need to know about roasting that goose?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that the sweet spot of cooking a goose breast is somewhere around 135 to 145 degrees internal temperature.
So it's pink.
It's pink, yeah. Medium rare to medium. The sweet spot for the legs is somewhere around 175 to 180, give or take. You know, they're pretty forgiving. That's a huge spread in temperature, and you can't really pull it off. If you are stuck on that whole Norman Rockwell, I got to carve the goose at the table kind of image,
right,
which if you can get away from that, which I highly recommend you do, you can have your cake and eat it too. And the way you do it is this. Your goose is thawed. Your goose is at room temperature. You put Mr. Goose in a roasting pan,
right,
on a bed of very chunky root vegetables. And you get them all salted and you put some lemon in the cavity, maybe some garlic in the cavity, and you roast them. Simple as that. 325 degrees.
Breast down.
Breast up.
Breast up. Okay.
And after about 45 minutes or so, you check the breast temperature with a probe thermometer. And it should read around 135, 140. What you do is you pull the goose out at that point and then carve the entire breast off both sides. That's the key.
And then that gets set aside.
That gets set aside.
And Mr. Goose goes back into the oven.
Precisely. And then you can roast it as long as you want. I mean, if you want to hammer the legs and wings, you can cook it for another hour, hour and a half if you want.
Right.
It usually only takes about 45 more minutes though.
And you're using fairly low heat. So you're doing sort of a slow roast on the goose.
Yeah, and that's critical because there's so much fat on a goose, it needs time to render out. If you try to cook it at too high a temperature, the fat will scorch and it will not render properly.
Uh-huh.
So you get like this sort of globby, fatty, blah. You know, nobody likes that.
Okay. So I've now got the breast, which is going to be sitting around for 45 minutes to an hour. So something's
right,
going to have to warm that up. And I've got these juicy, tender legs and thighs,
mm-hmm,
right?
So when your legs and thighs are done, you pull the goose out and you let the whole thing rest. Now that's your cue to finish up the breast. Because yeah, you're right. The breasts have sit around for 45 minutes or so. And so they're cool. And plus that skin is no longer crispy.
Right.
Now's when you crisp up the skin. You get a big frying pan and then you put a little bit of that goose fat. You'll have plenty. Just put maybe a tablespoon down and then just kick the spurs to it. You know, medium high heat and you want to get a nice caramel brown on that skin. And it'll take 2 to 4 minutes or so. And that you don't actually necessarily need to do any more cooking on the meat side because the meat side is already cooked, right?
Right.
All you're doing is crisping up that skin.
Okay, so we've got the breast set up and it's ready to be sliced thin, right? What about the rest of the goose? How do you like to serve this whole thing?
A lot of times I will just pull the legs and wings off and then just serve them on the platter that way. But you can also crisp them up in the same pan that you did the breasts in. And that just gives you an added layer of crispiness to it. And it renders a little bit more fat out. I don't always do this, but it is helpful, especially if for whatever reason those legs did not get crispy as they cooked right in the oven.
It sounds fabulous. Hank, thank you.
Thank you.
Hank Shaw is the author of Duck, Duck, Goose, and you can find his recipe for roasting a perfect goose or duck on the website splendidtable.org. You know, if you have an old family recipe for a chocolate cake or chocolate cookies or even brownies, and you've not been able to make them taste as you remember, I'm here to tell you, you're not imagining things. Chocolate has changed. And that means our recipes have to change. So for some guidance, we're turning to the baker's baker, Alice Medrick, a woman who has probably done more work with chocolate than anybody else I know. She's the author of Seriously Bittersweet. Alice, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be back.
So Alice, how is our chocolate different today?
We have a lot of chocolates, both domestic and from all over the world, that have more pure chocolate in them and less sugar. And that can profoundly affect the recipes that we make with them.
What do those numbers mean? Because that's the new thing, the percentages.
That is a big new thing. The percentages on the bar are telling us how much of the bar is pure chocolate as opposed to sugar. Now, when I say that, I'm really talking about dark chocolate. Let's put milk chocolate aside for now,
okay,
because there's
sure
more complications there. But if you see a bar called dark chocolate or semi-sweet chocolate or bittersweet chocolate, it has a number on it, that's telling you the percentage of that bar that is pure chocolate.
So the more intense chocolate flavor will be at the higher percentages.
Yes, because less sugar. The chocolate is bitter to begin with, and if you increase that and decrease sugar, you're getting quite a bit of extra flavor and bitterness, which can be a very good thing or can be a problematic thing for baking and making desserts.
This is a time of year when we look at a lot of old family recipes. If I use, I mean, the big deal now is a 70% chocolate. In a recipe that used to just call for bittersweet, will it be the same?
That's the perfect question. No, it will not. If you have old recipes from family or things you've been making for dozens and dozens of years that you love, regardless of the fact that it may call for semi-sweet and bittersweet chocolate, you should look for a chocolate with 60% or even less cacao percentage, because back in the day when that recipe was published, the chocolates that we had available and the chocolates that were used to create these recipes were all under 60% cacao.
So they were sweeter.
They were sweeter. And that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but the recipe was perfected with a sweeter chocolate. And if you switch to a much less sweet chocolate, you're not just going to get more chocolate flavor. Unfortunately, you might get some textures that don't work and maybe even too much bitterness. So the cacao percentage doesn't just affect sweetness. It profoundly can affect textures and how it feels in your mouth, as well as sweetness and flavor.
So if I do want to up the chocolate intensity of that old recipe, and I do want to use a 70% chocolate instead of a 60 or 50, what do I need to do?
Well, you know, that puts you into the realm of experimentation. You know, my book deals with that.
You've got formulas,
but
don't you?
In general, I have formulas that put you in the ballpark and help you make those translations. But getting back to your specific question, you would have to use, in most recipes, less chocolate and maybe adjust sweetness a little bit. Even if you want a more bittersweet flavor, you often have to adjust a little sweetness and use less chocolate, and sometimes you need to increase a little liquid. So it's a little more complicated than, okay, here's the how-to. Because those percentages mean so much to how the chocolate performs in a recipe, it's better now to shop by percentage and disregard the terms bittersweet and semi-sweet.
Ah, okay. You took a beloved old recipe, a great French classic, and evidently you threw pastry chefs a real curve. What did you do? It was chocolate mousse. You got to talk about what you did.
Well, you know, let me back up a teeny bit. I was interested in all the new kinds of chocolate coming into the market. And as I tasted them, I realized that they all had different kinds of flavor profiles. And I thought, well, if these flavors are going to come through, what kind of recipes do we need to not bury the distinctive, you know, flavors in the chocolate?
Right.
So I decided, you know, less fat, less cream, less dairy. And I ended up with chocolate mousse made with water, partly because I wanted to taste all the nuances in the chocolate, partly because my brother was coming over and he is lactose intolerant.
Reason.
So I thought, okay, let's make the mousse with water. And it was stunningly good. The chocolate flavors were very clear and clean and delicious. And then I put whipped cream on top of some of them and not on his.
But, you know, that's really interesting. You put whipped cream on top of something that's very, you know, pure chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the effect is completely different than if you fold the cream into it.
Exactly. And I love this comparison. Think about, you know, what tastes more chocolatey, chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream with great chocolate sauce on it? I personally love the contrast thing that goes on. And I think if you take a chocolatey dessert that's not too loaded with butter and cream itself and put whipped cream next to it, you intensify that chocolate flavor because there's this huge and wonderful contrast going on.
Great tip. Alice, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Alice Medrick is the author of Seriously Bittersweet, and you can find that recipe for that water chocolate mousse. It's called Albert's Mousse, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Afraid you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around. If it seems your friends desert you,
it's time to get in touch. The lines are open. 800-537-5252. Facebook and Twitter. And of course there's email, splendidtable.org. We've got Hannah on the line from Los Angeles. Hannah, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am fine.
I'm so pleased to talk to you.
Well, I'm pleased you call. What is on your mind, Hannah?
Well, I was in Malaysia last month.
Malaysia, you said?
Malaysia, yes.
Kuala
Lumpur. And I'm always going, when I'm traveling, going to grocery stores and finding all the, you know, bizarre products that I can pick off the shelf and bring home. And something big over there is nutmeg and candied nutmeg.
Ooh.
And so, and it was sort of in the confectioner's aisle. And I bought it, and it's dried nutmeg that's a bit gummy, and it's just with a tiny bit of sugar and salt, and it's very nutmeggy. And I cook for myself all the time. But I don't do a ton of baked cookie type things, which I think that would be great in. But I was wondering if you had any recommendations of things I could use that in savory ways.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, okay, so it's dried nutmeg. Is it really shriveled up into small nuggets?
It's small strips, but it retains some sort of chewiness.
Okay, I wonder if it's really the... Is it the casing around the nutmeg, the mace? Well, whatever it is, it's tasting a bit like nutmeg, and it has a chewiness, and it's salty.
Pungent.
Yeah, and it's salt and sugar,
uh-huh.
and it's really pungent. And what occurs to me...
I thought like I could do shortbread, and I could do mulled wine and mulled ciders, and that would be...
Yeah,
cool.
You could, yeah. But but imagine if you did something like a soup, where you had
maybe a ginger garlic base. I'm thinking of either something based on a laksa or based on a pho, you know, a Vietnamese pho, where you use star anise and you use cinnamon stick and you have garlic and you have ginger and you have heat. You know, you have chili. And that nutmeg, a few of those go in there in the mix. And it's not that it's going to kill it, but it's going to give it – you already have plays of sweet, hot, tart, warm aromatic spices, which, you know, nutmeg and cinnamon and all that are part of that. I just think fool around with doing broths and then you throw in the vegetables, you add whatever, you know, you want tofu, you want whatever, and you can do noodles in that. I would even wonder, what would that be like in a soup that had tamarind in it?
Oh, my God, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I would fool around. Remember, you're looking at cuisines all of Southeast Asia where sweet, tart, funky, like, you know, what fish sauce brings, what fermented bean paste brings, and then you've got the heat, and you've got all those really fundamental flavors playing. This sounds like it would play beautifully in that environment.
I think so. That sounds so inspired.
I think it could really be fun. I don't know if it's inspired, but it's just, that's where I would go initially and start out with just a few in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will.
Okay. Enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Hannah. Have a great time with it.
Thanks, Lynn. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or you can actually call us, 800-537-5252. Melinda says, we're hosting 18 people for Christmas this year, and I need to have beef as a centerpiece of the meal. Now, our butchers suggested initially to use a tenderloin or a prime rib. Melinda, your butcher is paying his mortgage for the next 2 months with that suggestion. And Melinda has realized the price is prohibitive. So he then thought about top round, and he could fillet it and they could stuff it and slice it. So what do I think? Is it a good choice? Okay, it's a good choice because it's a solid piece of meat. So it's going to be very neat and tidy. Now, the top round, it tends to be not heavily marbled. So this is what you want your butcher to do. You want him to open it up like a book, okay? So you cut down the middle, or you can cut in a spiral, you see? So you have about an inch thick, long rectangle of meat. Now, here's how you're going to guarantee that that meat is going to be tender. You ask him to pound that sucker so that it's about a third thinner. So if it's, let's say, an inch thick, it's about 3/4 to 2/3 of an inch thick, because that's going to break down the tissue and that's going to tenderize it. Now what you want to do is season it. And what I suggest is you do a dry brine. And if you go online, you're going to find lots of recipes. But the idea behind a dry brine is that if you have about 3 days, you're putting salt and herbs on the meat, and eventually that will draw juices out of the meat, and then those juices will be drawn back in. It'll make the meat juicy and delicious and tender. Now what you do is you take a cooked filling, and one of the things I love is to do a golden rice, cook it with turmeric, do some cooked sausage that has real flavor. It doesn't have to be spicy. I love to use Scandinavian sausages for this. And you cook them, thin slice them. They get rolled in with raisins and pistachio nuts and fresh greens like fresh chopped spinach, little strings of it, and some chopped scallions. So it's beautifully colorful, but you're not worried about cooking it. And now what you're going to do is spread that over the meat. You're going to roll it up just like a jelly roll, okay, the long way or the short way. I suggest the long way because it'll be longer and thinner and cook a little faster. Tie it with string every couple of inches and then slow roast it, basting it with a bit of red wine. And I would do it at about 325. And the idea is that you want the inner curl of the meat to be medium rare. So when you tuck in an instant read thermometer into that center meat, it's going to be about 125, 130. Let it rest for about 10, 15 minutes. Slice it into beautiful medallions, and they're going to look gorgeous. Golden rice, green pistachio nuts, and this delicious succulent beef. It's a little complex, but trust me, do it step by step. It's really simple. And have a great dinner. You can send us an email. You can go to splendidtable.org, and you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Ben is calling from Chicago. Ben, what can I do for you?
I am going to make a country ham for the first time, and that's fine. I've investigated how to make it and everything. I've decided what I'm going to do. But I didn't, you know, when I was a kid, you get ham, it's honey-baked spiral ham, and you always get scalloped potatoes made out of cream of mushroom soup. But I was wondering what maybe some of the standard side dishes were to go with it.
Well,
like when you make pulled pork, you always make coleslaw and baked beans, but what do you make when you make
ham? Well, first of all, country-baked ham is often done with biscuits. Homemade biscuits served warm, and the ham is thin sliced, and you eat it with the biscuits. Now, that is not necessarily the main dish. That's the way you might serve it if you're serving it as a starter. Sliver the ham, and you put it on these wonderful little biscuits. But the other thing that's often done with it is that you take that ham. You have to thin slice it. You know, big chunks of it are not going to work. It's going to be too chewy. So you slice it into very thin slices. You tend to do sweet sauces with ham, kind of sweet. So you might take port wine, some red wine, some of the drippings from the ham, but they're going to be kind of salty, but some of the drippings from the ham, and you simmer that together. You may want to add, a little broth to that. And you can look up, you know, there are red currant sauce recipes for ham. There are all kinds of recipes. One of the things I like to do is I take dried apricots, I soak them in a bit of white wine with a little bit of chopped onion, and then I simmer that down. And or I saute the onion first, and I take the apricots that have been soaked in the wine with the wine, and I throw in cinnamon, I throw in a bit of garlic, I throw in black pepper. And then I sweeten it to taste. I want it to be a little sweet tart. And a little bit of that, it goes out in a gravy boat, but a little bit of that goes over that country ham.
See, I was going to short-circuit all that and just make a glaze out of, like, major grade chutney or something like that.
Oh, you could. No, but seriously, you actually, oh, absolutely, you could. But if you want to serve it, you know, give it another bit of oomph, that major grade chutney could go into a sauce like this. You see what I'm saying? And it would carry it through. And then the idea is that with that ham, potatoes are really great. But some people do grits. You know, it all depends where your ham is coming from. But some people do creamy, you know, cheese grits, which could make you weep, and greens, which is just, you know, fabulous. You can use collards and spinach and all kinds of greens that you cook together. Natalie Dupre, if you find any of Natalie's recipes, they will be utterly sensational.
Okay, great.
So enjoy your country ham.
All right, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Jamie is on the line from Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Jamie, hi, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm calling about a tradition that my family has started that I'd like to share with your listeners.
Sure.
Called the Great Cookie Bake-Off. And this started years ago when I was growing up. My mother, for the holiday season, would bring out all of our family's recipes, and we and our family bake. We're bakers. And she would pull down about 20 different recipes from the typical American family. We have Italian roots, Welsh, Scotch-Irish, and European roots. And so we would have all of these different cookies that we would bake every year. But as we grew older, we all went off to our own homes, and we sort of baked in isolation.
Right.
And my dear friend called me up and said, "We haven't seen each other in a while. We should get together." And I said, "Well, would you like to get together and bake with my family?" And so what we did was we all met in the middle at my sister's house in Indianapolis. I flew in from Harper's Ferry. My mother brought all of her recipes from Columbus, Ohio. Beth drove in from Springfield, Illinois with all of her family recipes. And for 4 days, four women, one baby, five dogs, all crammed into my sister's house baking from morning until night. And we were able to start this wonderful tradition that we've dubbed the Great Cookie Bake-Off.
What a wonderful idea this is.
Well, we just had such a great time. It was a wonderful way to get together. And one of the things that has been so much fun about the baking process is realizing how similar our recipes are. And we have a particular recipe called butter balls, which are a wonderful sort of nut cookie. And we realized that, you know, recipes really do unite us, because we gave them to a friend and she said, these aren't butter balls, these are Mexican wedding rings. And then another friend said, these are Russian tea cakes in my house. And my mother, for years when we were growing up, we would bake them. And then on Christmas Eve, she would take them to church and she would take them to friends and families and shut-ins. And she taught us that sharing recipes is just as important as making them.
Well, I think you've set off a set of dominoes.
I hope so. No. I hope there are great cookie bake-offs all across America.
I think it would be great. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We will talk next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Victor Borga, who said, a holiday miracle would be to still fit in my clothes. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. This month, we're doing something important here at The Splendid Table. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it has an effect on all of us. When you support The Splendid Table this holiday season, your gift will not only help us produce our program, but will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are going without. Visit SplendidTable.org to get more information on our partnership with Feeding America, as well as information on anything else you heard here today. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in, and have a happy new year. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.